Hello everyone, welcome yet again to yet another episode of Contact Lost and the LGT's Lucky 7. I'm your host Tweak. With me today I have my co-host Joker.
Yellow.
And our guest, whom you might have seen on the thumbnail already, or you might have seen his name and the topic that we are going to discuss somewhere on the internet, because I posted that earlier. But ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, the person who, in my opinion, has changed the way how people write about 40K, has contributed to, I think, one of the best websites out there when it comes to 40K content and miniature wargaming overall. I'm very keen to find out how he did it and his friends did it. Hopefully he will open up to us in a moment and tell us what the recipe for his success is. Everyone, we give you James Grover. Hello, James.
Thank you for that lovely intro. Great to be here.
It's great to have you. As I said, you, to me at least, are a role model. You are someone with great talent for writing and with great insight and great knowledge about 40K and beyond. So it's only natural to have you here. To our listeners, we are doing this series as a prelude, in a way, to the London Grand Tournament, as you might have guessed or as you might have heard in our previous entries. So the way it works is I pitch an idea of a top 7 list to our guests. They pick a topic, either from my list or of their own choosing, and we discuss it for an hour or an hour and a half. And this time, James has chosen the topic of top 7 units to watch after the balance data slate. And some of them probably are not the most obvious choices that you could think of. But before we get there, James, tell us something about yourself. Tell us something about your very, in my opinion, very successful website. How do you go about creating such a wonderful source of 40K knowledge as Gunhammer is?
I mean, the honest answer is sort of by accident. So we started Gunhammer, what must be 4, 5, or 6 years ago now. And the group of us basically met through various sort of online interactions, and then later on a Discord server, we'd all started to talk about 40K mostly. So we're very international, because we sort of met as an online group. So Gunhammer has a fairly big team in the UK and the US, but then we also have people in Australia and in various other places around the world. And I think a lot of the team we have got back into the game or got back into the game in earnest around 8th edition. And many of us, including me, had played the game when we were younger, but sort of fallen away from it over time. And in the intervening years, lots of us had been involved in sort of Magic the Gathering or other games. And when we came back to the game in 8th edition, which was a much more sort of, you know, tractable sort of game to play competitively and to try and dig into really from a stats point of view than anything that had gone before, we were all a bit surprised to find that there wasn't really sort of anywhere out there you could get the kind of written content we were all used to reading from our time playing Magic and other sort of games. I'm very into Hearthstone as well. And again, there are websites out there where there's lots of articles, you can keep up on what's going on in the metagame, it's all sorts of stuff. So we were writing sort of bits and bobs for each other, tournament reports and stuff, and in Discords and on forums. We decided to start putting on a website, and started getting a bit more serious about it. And then the way these things go, we had a few articles that really caught the imagination. So the big sort of breakout from a competitive point of view was one I wrote about how to use the 4 different assassins in 8th edition and how to play against them. That got enough people reading us and coming back for more that then they told their friends, and then more people came back for more. And it's really kind of spiraled and escalated from there. It helps that we were very, a lot of us have come to this having worked in sort of professional settings for a long time. So we've come at it with quite an understanding of how to put together a team, how to run a project, how to run a business. So I'm a consultant in my day job. And we have, you know, we have accountants, we have various software architects, all sorts of stuff on the team. So we have a very high powered team, and we were able to bring lots of our skills together to create something really good.
Yeah, so you create something that others can look up to, and I think, I mean, there have been many websites before you that tried to do the same thing, because I remember back in the day I used to follow like Spiky Bits or Blood of Kittens or something like that, but none of them seem to have exploded the way your website has, which is yeah, absolutely amazing. And nowadays I think you're on like on the lips of everyone. So like if someone is 40K and is thinking of a tactic or a strategy or something like that, you'll very often hear that Gunhammer has already did it, or Gunhammer
I
has already.
also feel like Goonhammer doesn't exactly compare to Spiky Bits and those kind of websites. At least I had the impression that the articles that popped up on Goonhammer were much more
In
had
depth.
more like depth maybe and less clickbaity kind of content. Either way, I'm very thankful for the endeavor you've got going on, James, with your friends, because I'm much more of a reading person than a podcast listener, for example. So during all sorts of meetings that a usual corporate worker might have, I can grab a good read about 40K or anything like that. So I'm a fan.
Yeah, I think that was the thing that really sort of we weren't sure going into it whether there wasn't the sort of lots of written content because nobody wanted it or because no one was doing it. Because when I got back in, there were lots of fairly well-developed podcasts, lots of YouTube channels. I watched quite a lot of Tabletop Tactics when I was first getting back in, and listened to. Oh, can't remember which one it is, which one it was now. One of the podcasts that Frontline Gaming put on, and there was lots of stuff out there for video or audio, but there just wasn't the written content, and we weren't sure, is it just that we're weird for wanting this, or if we start writing it, will people come? And the answer turns out is that yes, people do want written content. It's just it takes a lot of work to keep going, and I think it's only because we've got a fairly large team and a very professional, very motivated team that we can make that work.
All right. Okay. So tell us something about your experience with the LGT, because it's going to be the seventh edition. I remember you playing Necrons last year, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
So
But
last year, I think I was running Eldari.
why do I have the impression that that you were playing Eldar and like a non-standard Necron list? The entire day I was walking with my dogs and so on, and I was like,
Oh,
yeah, he was playing Necrons.
I can't remember. Maybe I did
That
play
actually
Necrons.
makes
Maybe.
two of us. I also feel like you've played Necrons.
Like you had
Maybe.
this non-standard Nicklac list or something like that, and I don't know, it's just so deeply stuck into my head. I don't know. Then correct us. Like, what was your experience last year
I
then?
can't remember what I was playing last year. Now you've got me confused. I thought I was playing an Eldar list, and eventually and ran into Inez's
Gene Stealer cults.
Genes of the
Yeah, he
Cult.
was
Yeah, which I
playing
forget.
30 bikes.
Yeah, he was playing way too many bikes, which was deeply upsetting of him. I think I was playing Eldar into it, but I could be misremembering. I am playing Necrons this year. Necrons is what I've been playing since the start of 10th edition. I've been really, really enjoying them, and haven't had that much interest in playing the Eldar, just because I tend to, because of the way I sort of engage with the game, because I sort of read lots of army lists every week to write my weekly column. I'm generally not that interested in playing something that's just obviously the best because because I'm already, trying to write many paragraphs about it every week. I don't feel like there's anything I'm going to sort of. I play the game at least partially because I want to understand it. I want to know what makes it tick. What works, what doesn't. So playing a really known quantity list isn't something I ever find that interesting. So given how dominant Eldari have been up till now in 10th, I've been sticking to the Necrons.
I mean, it's not that bad, I guess, because I remember, I think somewhere around mid-year last year when Harlequins were so dominant, so like all over the place. I remembered the articles like competitive innovations if Harlequins were there. It was like same shit over again,
Yes,
stuff
I must
like
admit,
that.
in that period, it did get a bit silly. I think the other big one for 9th edition was the point where just every other list was Grey Knight Dread Knights with Interceptors, just again and again and again. And I think, to be fair, like so obviously Eldari have been far too dominant in intent, but it's a new edition and people have been trying lots of other things. So there have been some quite interesting things to keep an eye on, sort of bubbling just below the Eldari. And I'm really looking forward to seeing that sort of fully unleashed now the metagame's had a stern correction.
All right. Okay. So yeah, coming back to my question about the LGT. So last year you were there. Was that your first ever edition, or have you played?
No. I've been doing the LGT pretty much every year since I got back in the game. So I played in the, maybe it was not, I can't remember if it was the first one or not, but I played in, I can't remember if it was 2018 or 2019, but I've been going along every year for a while now. The first one I played was the one at the Olympic Stadium with the foam terrain, and so it's a real transformation since then. I think the venue they've got now is fantastic, which is always nice. And yeah, I've been playing in the Invitational for the last 2 years as well. Usually, yeah, I have thus far I've mostly gotten knocked out in the first round at varying degrees of closeness, so we'll see how we do this year. My army's certainly in a better place metagame wise than it has been previously, so crossing my fingers.
We are in the same group, so we shall see. Maybe we'll face each other on the table, which will be absolutely amazing.
I'm about to give away my secrets, that's a problem.
On the other hand, I will definitely be starstruck when we are at the table, so you have that advantage already without even starting the game. So, all right, what makes you come back to the LGT? So, it sounds like a cliche question, but every answer so far that I had from people was different, and people appreciate something else about the LGT. So, is LGT like the pinnacle of UKTC tournaments, or what's your feeling about this?
So I think I really want to support it because I think it's fantastic that we have events of that scale in the UK. Certainly one of the sort of barriers when I first got back in the game was this feeling that everything revolved around the big US events. And I think it's really important that we have something comparable to that in the UK. And it's also just, it's an opportunity to see everyone. It's the one event where everyone will be there. And I've made lots of friends throughout the scene over the last, 5 years playing in tournaments. And it's the one time you'll see absolutely everyone. Catch up with anyone you haven't seen for a while and just play lots of games. I find the atmosphere around it does just tend to feel a bit more sort of convention like and special than other sort of other tournaments, just again partially because of the size, partially because there's a bit more sort of scope for open gaming, and that's that's changing a bit. So Warhammer Fest this year was great for that as well. I'm hoping that will happen again in the same way next year, but it does just give you that, it's that feeling of everyone being in the same place playing 40k that I really love.
Yeah, it almost feels like, I don't know, the Oscars with Hollywood stars all over the place or something like that. So everyone should come to that place to just see all the familiar faces that they see on the internet everywhere, because, it's an unforgettable experience.
Yeah, but there's also all these, well, I wouldn't say side events, but generally the tournaments for all the other gaming systems. There's just so many of them that, yeah, like Jim said, you really do get the feeling that it's a bit of a convention just for any nerd gaming system,
I think that's really important too, and I think it's, you get the economies of scale from having this kind of big event. It provides a venue where you can have these big tournaments for everything, and I think that's something that Zach's done really well in developing over the years of building up all those events beyond just the main 40k event. It's really interesting from our point of view as well, because we don't just cover 40k on our website, we've got people who write about pretty much everything. Kill Team is a big one as well, which has a huge event at the LGT. And it's great to have a sort of venue and a stage for the big events for everything.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, I think we can move on to the meat of the episode, so to say. So your top 7 units to watch after the data slate. Maybe as a short word of introduction, are you happy with the data slate, with the changes that it introduced?
Yes, I'm thrilled. I like I love almost all of it. The only thing I don't love is the change to how discounting stratagems work. I feel like the reserving it to battle tactics. I mean, it's I'm kind of in two minds about it. It does fix a lot of the problems, but I really liked the mechanic of free stratagems from leaders. I thought that was a really, really cool thing, and I think having it limited to battle tactics is almost a bit random, because it doesn't feel like necessarily the list of battle tactics was chosen based on the expectation that this would happen. So I think if I were doing that, I might have come up with something different. But other than that, I really like everything about it. I think a lot of the balance changes were really well targeted. I think the towering change is really good. I'm really excited. And thus far, from some initial sort of, obviously we haven't got a massive data set yet, but initially it looks like things have landed pretty well. And things are much more open now. So in general, yeah, I really, really like it. I think it's one of the best balance updates that Games Workshop has ever done.
Okay. So I understand that after the data slate had come out, you had a second look at some of the indexes, some of the units, and so on. Mm-hmm. And some of them have drawn your attention, or like rekindled your attention, definitely more than before. So I guess this is what this top seven is going to focus on. Is that like a correct assumption?
Yeah. So this is something that's been, so from one of the things that I do for the website is every week I write the competitive innovations column, and that means going through as much as possible every, you know, at least reading every X1 or better list from the past weekend, just so I've got to can write at least a sentence about all of them. And one of the things I get from that is that I, as well as seeing the really top units, I get to spot units that are in lists that you sort of look at them and go, okay, yeah, that's quite interesting. That's doing something interesting there. It might not be the best option, but it's doing something interesting. So I've got that sort of backlog of you know, data in my mind, so that when a balance update comes along, I can see, you know, okay, well, this unit was already turning up in the list and looked kind of okay, and now it's gone down by lots of points. So that's worth a real look in the post list like world, or maybe the thing that counters this has gone away. So that's something that I thought I wanted to talk about, because I think it's interesting as well. I think one of the things that 10th edition does well too is it puts much more of a focus on each individual unit rather than what's the most efficient single thing you can pile up lots of buffs on. Not always. I mean, there are still some factions that can do a bit of that, and there are some factions where which leaders can go with what kind of count some units out of contention, which is one of the I love leaders in general. I think it's a really good change for the game, but I think that's one of the things I don't like about it, is that there are some units that you look at and go, what this really needs is a good leader, and if they don't have one, then they're kind of stuffed. But in general, I think what each individual data sheet does is quite a bit more important. I think there's also a few sort of assumptions and things that people are used to from previous editions that have changed quite a bit, particularly in terms of permissiveness of what you can combo stuff with, and that's what's driven one of the choices I've got on my list here. So I thought it was an interesting thing to talk about. I'm afraid, I'm brutally honest, didn't have that much time available to prepare, so I needed to choose something that I can do from off the cuff almost.
No, but I think it's an amazing choice, especially that I think today is the day when. Today is the like cutoff for lists, or like so soon the lists for the LGT are going to be published. So it's going to be extremely interesting to see how prophetic your choices are, and if we actually see those units in the lists going into the LGT. So that's a great topic, and I think we can start with your choice. I don't know if you have them somehow ascending, descending. I don't think there is a need for that.
I've got a list of quick notes for each of them. Where do you want me to start? Do you want me to start Imperium, Xenos, Chaos? Where do you want me to go?
Give us whatever you want. Which one's your final favorite for any reason?
So I guess one, I'll start in my comfort zone on Eldari then.
Perfect.
So the first one to talk about is Fuegan, Fugan, I don't know how you pronounce it. I don't think so written down, the Phoenix Lord of the Fire Dragons. So Eldari obviously took a huge hit in the data slate, lots of point increases across the board. And thus far, most people seem to be sticking to pretty much the same units as before, just fewer of them, which is certainly one way to go. But I think it's certainly worth having a look at units that are already performing on some level and didn't go up in cost. So Fuegan stayed the same price, and he's an absolute monster. He isn't a lone operative, but you can basically use him like one because he's so durable. So what Fugan's got going for him is he's very dangerous in both shooting and the fight phase. Shooting, he can pick either a sort of sustained hit, damage to high AP, multiple shots attack, which is great for clearing out some space marines or whatever. Or he's got an absolutely gigantic single shot that's melter six, along with lots of damage. And the melter six there is actually really important. So I've been annihilated by this once playing as Necrons, because the way ordering of buffs works means if you're shooting at something that halves damage, you halve the base damage, but then you apply addition. So if you shoot, and that's how the RGT is ruling it as well. So if you shoot the Melter 6 profile into the Incarn or a Catan or whatever, and they'd normally half damage, they're suddenly using a massive chunk of their health in a way that almost nothing else will reliably do to them. And also the melee, yeah, so the shooting's good. The melee on him's really good as well. He's got lots of attacks at flat damage 3, which is an AP 4, which is lovely because Marine Gravis stuff is suddenly really good. So he'll happily wade through Gravis foes without too much bother. But what really makes him tick is his defensive setup. So like any good Phoenix Lord, he's got a 2-up save and a 4-up invuln, and is obviously a very small model too, so easy to hide. But he's actually substantially tougher than anyone else, except maybe arguably Azaman, who still is one of the few things in the game that still has a 3-up invuln, because he's got a 5-up feel no pain, which is great, makes it much harder to kill, means that most things that might one-shot him probably won't. Things that are doing like 5 or 6 damage probably won't quite get him in one shot. And the first time he dies, he gets back up on full health at the end of the phase on a 2+. So that means you can use him as a sort of pseudo lone operative, because although he isn't a lone operative, if you want to take him out, you have to hit him really hard in both the shooting phase and the fight phase. And you're doing that against an army that has access to fake dice as well. So if you hit him if you only give him one really big hit, then I'll just auto save it. And the occasionally you roll a 1 and get back up and I'll just die, which would be a shame. But in general, the amount of pain he can cause is considerable for how innocuous he looks on paper. And I think a few people had already cottoned on to him before the data slate. Apparently some teams at the WTC had him in their list. I've seen him in a few top lists going past events. But I think, again, when everything else goes down in efficiency and he's stayed the same cost, you really have to look at him hard. And again, also particularly because he's probably a winner from the towering change too, because if he's sort of somewhat out in the open, it's less likely a knight can just pop him from across the board.
One shot him, yeah.
He was included in the winning team Soldari list at the WTC, to be fair.
Yeah.
But you've mentioned there are a number of units that lack a good leader that would really take them above and beyond. Wouldn't Fugan be like the exact opposite, that he's a leader that kind of lacks a good unit that he can lead?
So for what it's worth, I think a unit of Fire Dragons with him is actually fine at this point. I think, because again, I don't think they changed in cost. They weren't miles away from good beforehand. I think the thing with the Eldari index is that it was so powerful in its launch state that units that would be fine in any other faction have just been left on the shelf. And you are starting to see people running Fire Dragons and Falcons anyway. So I think it would be entirely defensible to put in with a unit of Fire Dragons. but I think you basically don't need to, is the thing. But because part of the value you get out of him is that he's such a pain to put down quickly. If you put him with fire dragons, then that's, those are suddenly, you know, meaningful things your opponent can take out of the unit with ease. Whereas with him, you have to hit him, really hammer him, or you're not going to get him. And I think that's sort of why you're seeing him used by himself. So it is quite unusual. There aren't that many leaders like that. There are a few others. So Thousand Sons run some solo because they can do some very nasty things with stratagems, and also their leaders are a great source of Cabal points, so they can run solo ones. And then Grey Knights can run Librarians solo because they're a great source of mortal wounds. And again, they've got a bit of the Fugan energy in that, you know, they're a Terminator with a 2+, 4+, and a decent number of wounds. You aren't guaranteed to just melt them the second you look at them funny, whereas with a lot of leaders, they'll just die without a bodyguard.
I did purposefully avoid the word bad when asking about Fire Dragons, because obviously the Eldarion deck is ridiculous data sheets, but they're just probably too far down in the pecking order.
I don't think them. I'm going to be really interested to see. One of the things I'm watching at the LGT is whether the best, now that people have had a few weeks to adapt, whether the best Eldar lists are still just those ones that just take a lot less of the same units, or if we're going to start seeing people experiment a bit more widely. I think there are a few other units that I expect people to pivot to more as they get time to adapt. And I wouldn't be surprised to see probably just one unit, usually out of a Falcon, Fire Dragons doing okay.
So my next question might be a little bit premature because we are just at number 7 out of 7. But would you say, you know, after all your analysis of the edition, different index books and so on, that GW has done a fairly good job of making multiple units in an index appealing to take? Because previous editions had this, it was symptomatic for them that most codices had like one proper build, maybe two, and that's it. You didn't see, there were units that you would never see on the table, and Fugan was one of them. Like, I can't remember anyone apart from...
Oh yeah, he's been garbage. Like, he's been bunnies. Garbage for two solid editions, yeah.
Exactly. So do you think that this time GW has nailed it, and you know, you can pick and choose whatever you want from any book, and most of the things would see play? Or are we still fairly away from that state and they should tweak the units a little bit more?
So I think it varies a bit by book. I think the sort of design strategy for 10 does a better job of encouraging diversity. So as I mentioned before, one of the problems with previous editions is when you had these very, very broad suites of stratagems, army rules, and wide-ranging buff characters, what was written on each individual data sheet tended to end up mattering a bit less, because really what you were just looking for was the most efficient set of numbers to combine with whatever silly buff combo you wanted to pull off. And now that a lot more abilities have been moved to data sheets, and units are quite sort of are good at doing their thing in their own right, I think there's more of an appeal to try lots of things. But I do have to balance that. So I think in theory, that's the case. In practice, however, I actually think that you're seeing very samey army lists within factions at the moment. I think that's partially because we're at the edition start. So as codexes roll out, so we've seen the model with Tyranids, we're about to get Space Marines. As codexes roll out with lots of different detachments, I think you'll see a lot more of a sort of blossoming out of different things. But at the moment, there are people who experiment with different things, and I think some factions can do it better than others. I think it's clear that some indexes have ended up just having a bit more diversity. So I'd call out Necrons and Chaos Space Marines as being, I think, particularly deep for experimenting with. I think there's really loads of stuff you can do in those books. I mean, I think Necrons, I'd say, I'm slightly biased because it's one of my favorite factions, but I'd say they're probably the best of the indexes, just in terms of sort of all-round rules quality. There's a lot of different stuff you can do in there. Most of it's viable, interesting. I think some of the melee stuff's a little bit underpowered, but even that's actually not miles off good. So I think with that, there's some real scope to experiment. other factions, I think, have ended up a bit too, ended up more sort of focused on a few builds than I think probably than either we want or Games Workshop want. I think Gene Stealer Cults have suffered from it. I think although Eldar has a ton of depth, and basically people could bring, you know, random units just to flex alongside the usual suspects, realistically you were best just taking the same stuff every time. I guess Imperial Knights actually have been surprisingly varied in what they've been running. Like, I think people, you often ended up on, you sort of could take Crusader Warden as a default, but there were a lot of viable options there. So I think in general, in theory, there's some really good incentives in there. But I think the risk, I suppose, is that when the abilities are all on the data sheets, if you've got a suite of data sheets that form a really slick combo, then you can't do that with anything else. So you just end up building every list around them. So I'm going to be really interested to see. I think that'll be particularly interesting to see when the Marine Codex comes out, when that gives them however many detachments end up being in it. Because that will hopefully, because obviously everyone has Marines, so people are going to try out everything in there basically. So we'll see what emerges. And we've got a pretty good schedule of codexes for the rest of the year. So I think probably come Christmas, the answer will be, yeah, this is working. Right now, I am noticing that you know, armies like Gene Stealer Cults, which in theory there's quite a lot of things to play with, are almost unit for unit the same across different players.
One of our listeners asks, are there any bad units in the Elder Index? Scorpions, perhaps?
No, Scorpions are fine. Scorpions are actually one of the units that I think people have slightly underrated. They've turned up in winning lists. There's things you can do with them. They're one where you do want to bring Karandras because you need the unit to hit hard enough. I mean, essentially, I've been sort of amusing myself by working out whether any units in the Index haven't made it into a 4-1 list so far. I think Wraithlords are bad. I think there is basically no reason to ever take a Wraithlord. That's kind of it. I think everything else has a place. Everything else has something you could do with it. Wraithlords kind of garbage though.
Okay. There is something. Just one. Moving on with the top seven. What is next on your list?
Okay. So next, let's jump over to Chaos and look at the Great Unclean One. Chaos Demons. So Chaos Demons. So one of the things I'm always really. Look at how big he is there. Very impressive. One of the things I've always keen to do is to sort of check my own work and to look back on what I got wrong. I'm just as interested in what I got wrong in my predictions as what I got right, because it helps you sort of hone that for the future. And I think Chaos Demons were probably the army I and our team were widely underrated the most coming out of our sort of reviews of the indexes. I think the you know, part of the drive for that has been just how good Bellicor's aura is. The preventing them being shot from a distance means that some armies that have been dominating the game just can't interact with them out the gate like they would against anything else, which gives them a sort of big wild card energy. But I think just in general, the sheer quality of their big monsters has really helped them. Which has been reflected in the balance data site. So unlike factions that either went very up or very down, they got a much more of a mixture. They got some nerfs, some buffs, and in general, the big stuff that's in lots of lists got more expensive. But the troops and some of the sort of glue units that have been slightly underperforming so far got a bit cheaper. But the Great Unclean One kind of bucks that trend in that he went down in price and has already been seeing some use. So I think most top lists have been running the, you know, double Lord of Change, Bloodthirster and Bellicor or Shalxi. But you have seen the Great Unclean One get some use. And I think you're about to see quite a bit more of it. A, because it's cheaper, I mean, obviously, anything that, you know, you can pay for the increase of cost on one of your other greater demons by swapping one out for a greater P1 with the endless gift. Sorry, I should clarify. You pretty much, you only ever want to take one, and you want to take the endless gift on it for the big feel no pain. The other thing is that the way people have been using them up till now has basically been as a, something you can drop on a point that's not in Bellicor's aura and still expect to take a reasonable amount of pain to soak up. I think with the significant reduction in the number of Wraith Knights in particular in the metagame, that strategy is suddenly a lot more viable. The fact that you can't get sniped by Knight Crusaders helps a lot as well, because Knight Crusaders are really good at killing the Greater Unclean One because they're running off a feel no pain and but not a very good save as their main defense. So just lots and lots and lots of shots at, you know, damage two or three is a good way of killing one, particularly with the plus one to wound strat. Now that the Knight Crusader can't just no scope it, now that you're not dealing with Wraith Knights blowing you off a point, I think that plan of giving you something you can take away from your main bubble, because the challenge demons can have is that they want they need to stay bubbled up around Bellicor, at least out the gate, and they can end up being too static if they don't sort of brought, you know, move out at the right point, and they can end up with some challenges controlling the board. So having something that can act as a really solid anchor, I think, is a better strategy in general. And I think a lot of I think everyone should be sort of recalibrating their estimations a bit, because you don't need to be Lich Guard tough to be in the open or to be sort of on the table as much anymore. I mean, obviously Lich Guard tough is still good, but you can go a bit further down the tough scale and still expect to get some value. So I think the environment's better for them. They were already kind of okay, and their cost went down. So I think they're a really solid choice now. The other thing with them too is that because they have a toughness debuff they can throw out, the they help all the smaller stuff chips and wounds through. So I think they're really, if you're running horrors or you're running you know, a squad of playbearers or whatever, then that gives you a way of helping get some damage through.
Do you think that great, because I don't know, Death Guard players or Chaos players in general tend to turn towards Nurglings as those little cheap action monkeys that are very reliable and you can deep strike them. They have only advantages, I would say. But would you say that Great Unclean One also has this potential to be allied? Is he as potent formation? Yeah.
So I'd say no, because mm-hmm. you really do want the endless gift on them to give them the feel no pain. I think without the feel no pain, they're a bit mediocre. So they're very locked into to being run in a dedicated demons list.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. It's a huge buff, that enhancement. And if you can't take it, because I've seen people trying to squeeze a Great Unclean One into Chaos Knights list, but I agree with you. It just doesn't pay off if you can't take the enhancement, because you're essentially having 10 wounds less on him without it, if my math is right.
Yeah, I've seen some people running some of the named ones alongside Chaos Knights. So I've seen a Chaos Knights list running Shalxi alongside it, and I think that's a much better choice, particularly because Shalxi can have a 5-up feel no pain just off their data sheet. So I think that's the way. If you want to ally them, the named ones are the way to go, because they've kind of got things that are a bit like
inbuilt,
you know, enhancements built into them.
Okay, by the way, I'll stop with the top seven for a second. This is not going to be the most elegant demonstration of something, but look at this, look what I found on the internet.
Fine. I genuinely can't even remember what list I was running then. I must have been running the Destroyer Heavy one. Fine.
Okay. I think it was Niklag. I remember.
No, I want to say, what was the?
It would have been Novok.
Combat one.
Oh, sorry, Novok.
It would have been Novok. Yeah. If I was running Necrons, it would have been Novok at that point.
So that wasn't. I remember.
No, you're right.
It wasn't a standard choice at that time. And you were running like the less popular list, and I think that's why it stuck in my head so much. But yeah, we digress. Go away. All right. Moving on to your fifth choice. maybe.
Okay. Yeah. So let's go over to Imperium now. So this one is one I think we're going to see quite a lot of, is Marnius Kalgar, the chapter master of the Ultramarines himself. For those who don't know what he does, because Marines have not been doing fantastically up until now, but I think we're going to see a lot more of them in the next few weeks, because they've got their big points changes, and then they've also got their codex imminently coming out, which should give them plenty more options. So Kalgar comes with his Victrix Guard buddies, who had a nice supply of extra wounds with a good inbound into the unit as well. He's pretty good, pretty meaty combatant. It's not cheap. I think he's 185 points after the data slate. But he hits fairly hard in melee, because he's got nice damage 3 twin linked attacks, which is a good place to be. And he's got all right shooting, but I think really it's the buffs that make him so useful. So what Kalgar does basically is he means your unit is kind of not rules wise, but effectively has all three doctrines on all the time. In that you've got advanced charge, fallback and charge, and shoot, and fallback and shoot all the time for the unit he's with. And the unit that goes fantastically with is aggressors, who are who also got a point cut in the data slate. And aggressors are way, way, way more nasty than I think anyone has noticed thus far. But they're about to find out just how horrible they are. So at one of the very first games of sort of 10th edition I played outside our testing group was there was UKTC event at the on the open sort of the release weekend of 10th edition, and Zach provided the opportunity to just go and play some pickup games of 10th rather than the main event if you didn't feel like playing 9th. And because my head had been in sort of 10th edition writing reviews and stuff for a while, I didn't really have it in me to play another 9th event at that point. So I went and played some pickup games with my Necrons, and I discovered what Kalgar and a bunch of aggressors will do to a unit of Necron warriors, and it's not pretty. I've played the Necron warrior brick in quite a lot of games, and I think Kalgar's aggressor blob made shorter work of them than anything else, including Wraith Knights. So particularly because I think Necron warrior blobs look really good in the wake of the data slate. I think Kalgar offers a huge amount to aggressors. He makes it incredibly flexible, sort of all round a brawler unit. He adds enough melee imp that they hit properly hard in combat. The shooting they unleash is outrageous. They're much faster than people expect because of the advance and shoot. And you can put it with other stuff too. He's all right with Blade Guard. There's a few things like him that sort of push Blade Guard towards being quite good. I think the other thing with him is we've had some Warhammer community previews of Space Marine detachments. A thing to remember is that the combat doctrines are the detachment ability of the Gladius Task Force. So at the moment, you have to run the Gladius Task Force if you're running Ultramarines, but presumably once the book's out, there'll be a bunch of other detachments where combat doctrines isn't the ability. So at the moment, you're not going to be getting full value of him on one turn, at least one turn of the game, because your unit, well, you've turned on the doctrines, your unit would already had that. But in a world where not every Marine army has combat doctrines, having a leader who puts a really good unit into all the doctrines all the time effectively is even more valuable. So I think you're going to see a lot of use for him. In fact, we've already seen him turn up in some Marine lists since the data slate. I think we're going to see him a lot more. He also gives you a free CP every turn. I forgot that bit, but yes, he gives you a free CP every turn. That's anything that does that's really good now that with the free stratagem changes, because it's harder to get CP efficiency just by discounting stratagems. So Imhotep's a real take in Necrons now as well, because you can't just rely on overlords to give you the free strat. So I've got Imhotep in my LGT list. I think anything with that ability on the data sheet becomes more valuable. I think the final thing to say with him, which is a bit of a theme with a few other things that I'm going to talk about, is that people are used to the way things worked in 9th, where he was pretty much just always outclassed by Gilliman. But because of now the way, because things work differently and because of the way leaders work, they're not really competing for the same capability anymore. So I think he's really worth a look. And if you're a Marine player who has him and hasn't tried him, I'd say give him a go, particularly if you like aggressors.
So to somehow prepare to facing him on the table. What do you think is the, like the most standard way of playing him? Since he regenerates CPs, I understand that he cannot really be in a transport. Does it mean that he will be foot slogging with his unit, or what do people do with him?
So there's a couple of options with him. So I think sort of foot slogging with aggressors seems to be the most common way. Like an aggressor unit is tough enough that, particularly if you want to just chuck Armor of Contempt on them, they're not going to just die to a stiff breeze. Again, that's even more true with the Towering Change, because they're not just going to get sniped out by a Wraith Knight or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I think just foot slogging with the aggressors is the most likely way to see him. You can try a few other things, but I think one of the only problems with him is that because he adds three models to the unit, if you want to put him with a decent sized Gravis unit, you're going to need a Land Raider Crusader rather than a regular Land Raider, and I don't like the weaker firepower the Crusader brings to the table. I think I've seen a few people trying Crusaders, and my opinion thus far is that unless there's a really, really busted melee unit you can put in them, I prefer going with a smaller unit and a Land Raider, one of the other Land Raiders. I think the guns on the other ones are much better. I think the Crusader can end up being a bit pillow-fisted for its price, and you really want every unit to be doing something. So I think I favor him foot-slogging. I did see a list that has the option of dropping him in from Deep Strike with a Real Ventress, and you will lose a turn of your free CP if you do that, but mm-hmm. I think sometimes that's worth doing. Like again, in my Necron list, I'm running Imhotep in the same unit I've got the Veil of Darkness in, so I'll lose out the free CP the turn I do that, but I still think that, you know, it can be worth it if the time calls for it. But I think in general, you're worrying about foot-slogging aggressors, and the thing you need to worry about is that they are much, much quicker than you're going to expect them to be.
Mm-hmm. All right, very cool, Charles. Very interesting. That's one of the things that I, when I said at the beginning that not an obvious choice for me, that is the epitome of not an obvious choice. But now that you've justified it, it sounds like a force to be reckoned with, to be perfectly honest. So looking forward to seeing him on the table. What's number five?
So number or four, four,
depending four, on...
Three, yeah, yeah. Which so let's jump back to Chaos and do the Thousand Suns Demon Prince. So this is the regular foot-slogging one, not the winged one, just for reference. So there's been a much more of a division between the winged and the foot ones in this edition than previously. So the foot ones tend to be more buff-oriented, whereas the winged ones are fly out and kill stuff, and bluntly in Thousands, you don't need the fly out and kill stuff option. You've got Magnus, or you've got suicide characters running off to throw grenades and cast doom bolts for that. You are not getting the value from the doom. It's what the foot one does, though, is he provides you a aura that gives you stealth Thousand Suns units within 6 inches, and also is a pretty decent melee combatant. He's got either some big damage three attacks or a sweep, or lots of sweep attacks for one damage, and as an all right gun as well, some number of damage two shots. Finally, he also has a once per game ability where you can give rubric or scarab occult unit nearby precision on their weapons. So the Thousands of Demon Prince is something that again, I saw this go past in a few Thousand Suns. This Thousand Suns are one of the factions that's polarized quite a lot in terms of builds. Partially because they don't have that many units, but what that means is that whenever a unit turns up that isn't sort of in the regular suite, it sort of catches my eye. And I saw a few people using it and went, okay, that looks okay, because stealth makes your units go a lot further. They've already got some pretty tough, durable things. Stealth in general is better this edition than it was previously, because there are still plenty of rerolls, but there are fewer. You aren't always facing rerolls, so you will generally get a bit more value out of minus one to hit. And you're not sort of, and it's not parasitic with dents anymore, because dents doesn't exist. You're not going to be, and because weapons tend to have the minus one to hit from heavy built into their profile rather than being something that gets applied when they move. So it's now their base BS is worse, and they get plus one when they stay stationary. Minus one to hit tends to be a better ability in 10th edition than it was in 9th edition. And I found it's particularly good in, it's slightly less relevant now, but it's particularly good in the Gene Steel Occult matchup, because it mitigates the pain of some of what they can do on their go turns a bit more. Yep. than almost anything else will. Like, you know, they can still high roll and wipe your unit, but it does mitigate the pain a bit. And it's also going to be really good against Grey Knights too, who I think are much more of a metagame force after the data slate, because they really one of their problems is a lack of rerolls. So I think the stealth ability, I mean, so I guess the context for this is that the unit went down massively in price. I think it was one of the bigger drops out there. I think it was from
30 points.
Yeah, it was a lot of points.
It's also the only unit in the... Or maybe not the only one, but one of the very few ones.
It honestly might have been, Thousand Suns got hit fairly hard. Almost everything else went up. The Demon Prince went down a lot. And because what it does is makes your other units go further, that's really something you've got to be looking at. Is if you're finding yourself with fewer units, something that's both gotten cheaper and gives you, you know, keeps your units in the game longer, that's very valuable to you. And the rate on it is just kind of good at this point. Like, it's not trivial to kill. They can be shot at, but they're reasonably tough. They've got a 4-up invuln save, they've got a decent number of wounds there, and they've got access to the, you know, Thousand Run stratagem sheets to shrug off wounds as well, which is very, very potent. They're a nice sort of defensive force multiplier. They give you a bit of counter charge potential if your opponent's getting your face. Again, they're another thing that's pretty good at killing Gravis Marines. They've got a good number of flat number 3 attacks. The other thing was also, I think, the precision trick they've got, the once per game precision, is it's one of the things that a lot of the time you'll just look at it and go, oh, this isn't really doing much for me. And they're just very occasionally you'll have the perfect moment where it's amazing. So I think the Necron matchup is certainly one to think about with that, because Necrons are very reliant on their leaders. And if you can combine, if they're run, particularly if they're running the Warriors without Orokan or Lich Guard with a Lord rather than an Overlord, if you switch on precision and then turn off their armor saves with Twist of Fate, then suddenly you can toast their key leaders and they'll lose all their buffs and lose a lot of their defensive tricks. So I think it's quite a powerful tool in that matchup, which is one that is quite tricky for Thousand Suns now that they're down stuff.
So, Michal, I've seen in the Contact Lost Discord, I've seen you discussing Thousand Suns with Polish national team's Pumba, who is also a Thousand Suns player. And I saw that the Demon Prince was one of the topics of your discussion. So have you actually decided to include the Demon Prince in your list, or are you still unconvinced?
I am testing one of my MSU rubric lists with the Demon Prince, whereas I do think that he has more value in the Scarab Brick build. Nonetheless, I've only managed to play one game with it against Necrons, where it didn't prove to be that valuable, because like I said, you only give the precision buff to one unit, and if you're playing
if you're doing MSUs,
they don't have that firepower to actually make use of it into a 20-man warrior brick. And you can actually play around the precision by keeping the characters behind the wall, because precision actually requires you to still see the model that you're trying to precisely kill, snipe out. So that's that. After one game, I don't really have that much to say about it. We'll definitely try him again, because the stealth has actually been a little bit useful.
Yeah, I can imagine the stealth works better in the MSU style list, because it just means that the amount, when you've got lots of units down, the amount that the opponent has to commit to reliably kill one, just pushing that up a little bit makes it much harder for them to do their target priority.
Yeah, definitely. And also, you can push Magnus a little bit more aggressively, perhaps, because he's just a little bit more durable.
Yeah, minus one damage, goes a long way.
Are you trying to say that he is even more durable than before? Because I have nightmares about Magnus and killing him already with my Veth Guard. So are you trying to say that you're making him even more durable?
Yeah. Please don't. Yeah, I've had games where he's gone down in a single turn, so, you know.
Not against me.
You just need to roll better, mate. And you know it.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for Contact Lost Dice. When I have those, yeah, definitely, I'm going to roll better.
We're digressing.
You were digressing, yes. Joker, for one major and hopefully last digression, would you like to do the raffle now? Are you ready for that? Because we promised our listeners something. Is it the time now for that?
I am ready. Let me try to bring this up on the screen.
Right, so in the meantime, everyone who is watching, first of all, thank you, chat, for being here and for watching. This is something that our listeners have been waiting for, because we did promise you a raffle for when we reach 1,000 subscribers on YouTube, which is a massive achievement, and we wouldn't have been able to achieve that without your contribution. So thank you to everyone who subscribed. Thank you to everyone who follows us on Facebook and on every other social media. To say thank you for that, we have this magical spinning wheel here. Let me just switch something on. The award for the award for or in the raffle is a paint set, like this mega paint set from Army Painter. So we have the logo in the corner now. Make sure that you go to their website, check out their products, and just support them as well, because they're an amazing company. And Joker, mic over to you, I guess.
Thanks. Any chance you can drag that logo over the random ad?
Which logo, sir?
The clothing one, the Army Painter logo. Or is it too much of a hassle to try doing it live?
I can... Is there anything else that you want me to do? Because...
No, just that. But also, it's not of the highest priority. And I can just spin the wheel if it's too much trouble. Right, so we did decide to be a little more generous here, because the way this was supposed to work, people were supposed to like and share a Facebook post. Unfortunately, it turns out that some people who have liked it did not share it, and some people that shared did not like it. And for some reason, Facebook also doesn't want to give me the full list of people who shared that.
Me neither. That post. I couldn't see it. So,
which is odd.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, without any further ado, let us spin the wheel of doom and see who is the winner of a Speed Paint mega set that will be shipped to you sooner or later.
Don't tell me it's Zozo. Yeah,
it's Zozo.
For a second there, I thought it would be Meissen, who is part of Contact Loss. So this would be a little bit awkward.
I did put him on the list. I did exclude myself from this list, so at least I had that bit of decency to me. But yeah, well, luckily enough, there's no need to be suspicious. This has not been rigged, and Zozo is the rightful winner of this paint mega set.
Right, but let's do a small surprise. Can you remove Zozo from that wheel and draw again? Because I have a little surprise award for another person, so that someone else gets a chance. I have this, which is an untouched, unread Leviathan book.
Oh, okay. No need to put myself back on the list then.
It's the story of Leviathan, so by Darius Hinks. So please draw again so that we can see who the book will go to. Julian or Julian? Do we know which Julian? Do you have the info?
There's only one Julian that liked the Facebook post, so I will find his full name.
Okay, great, cool. All right, so congrats to our winners. We will contact you via Facebook to get in touch. Sorry, to agree on the like shipment method and so on, and to confirm that you're subscribed to the YouTube channel as well. And now we are back to our content, back to James. Sorry, James. Hope no this problem. Didn't take too much. Let me re-share my screen with your top 7 list. And I guess we can carry on.
Yeah. So let's go Imperium next. So I think the next two are probably the ones that people are gonna find most controversial, I think. So the first of these is Arco Flagellants, which are a Adeptus Sororitas unit. So this unit's been weird in that I think for a lot of the sort of the full Sisters book in 8th and 9th, they've actually not been miles off good. I think they've usually been vastly overshadowed by Repentia, who were just so brutally efficient in the previous two editions that it was very difficult to ever justify not taking them. But I think they fill a fairly different role now. So what Arco Flagellants are basically is just a decent pile of wounds and attacks for not that many points. They're another thing that's gone down in price after the data slate. And although they have paper thin 7+ saves, which obviously is not really a save at all, they're two wounds each. They've got a 4+ feel no pain. And anyone who's played against Crypt Thralls will know that a 4+ feel no pain goes a very long way. And it's particularly good on two wound stuff because it means that the first two damage hit that gets you very rarely outright kills you. You've got some chance of tanking a three damage one as well. And it just means that the amount of punishment your opponent has to sink into them is vastly outstrips what they're probably expecting. And I think they're at the price they are now, a unit of 10 of them is a pretty decent annoyance. And I think that's partially because they neatly showcase one of the sort of the more sort of general design changes in 10th, which is that there are a lot with fewer stratagems and stuff to go around. There's a lot fewer stuff where they've carved out exceptions about what can or can't do stuff. So last edition, Arco Flagellants and a lot of the other Ministorum stuff weren't really fully compatible with a lot of the Sisters Codex abilities, which tended to be a part of why you didn't see very much of them, is that you didn't get synergies, buff auras and stuff. Now they're just they're an Adeptus Sororitas unit. They have Acts of Faith on their data sheet. They can use quite a few of the stratagems, and that's particularly relevant for them because it means you've got access to Acts of Faith for a reliable charge out of Strategic Reserve. So I think if you're running these, a unit of 10 coming out of Strategic Reserves is a really good way of doing it. And then they're also have access to the Holy Rage stratagem, which gives them +1 to wound, and their weapons were already twin linked. So the combination of twin linked and +1 to wound is pretty great wherever it turns up, because it means that in a very worst case scenario, Inesripan has -1 to wound as well, which is pretty rare. Overwhelmingly, you're wounding on fives with rerolls, so that's a 55% conversion rate against in the very worst case. So that tends to mean you can get some damage done into a lot of different targets. Like they do struggle a bit with 2+ saves because they don't have access to any AP, so you do need to pick your targets if your opponent's using a lot of them. But again, there's plenty of stuff they are good into. They've got enough volume. I mean, if you put them into overdrive mode, basically they've got 6 attacks each with sustained hits, so you're putting a good chunk of hits and then wounds into pretty much whatever you target, enough that they will just drag some stuff down, and then they take enough of effort to counterpunch that they are going to be annoying once they're in position. They also don't have any of the things that sort of stop them doing actions or objectives as well, which is always nice, so you can just do stuff with them. I think they're probably a bit more of a sleeper choice because I'm not certain. I'm not certain whether Sisters got quite as much help as they maybe needed in the data state. I think they're one of the factions that probably didn't get quite as much of a lift as they were looking for. Although I could be wrong on that. But I think if you're in that situation, anything that gives you a cheap role player is really valuable. So I think if, again, I've seen a few of these go past in army lists, I think they're a promising unit that's worth a real look now. And I think the fact that you can now combine them with stuff where previously they were sort of locked out of a lot of the army rules is something that makes them worth another look. Although not perfectly. I did remind myself when I was sort of preparing for this, I had this vague moment in my head, you can take leaders on them, but I don't think you should. And yes, I reminded myself why. It's because one of the leaders they can take gives them sustained hits, which they already have, and the other one gives them +1 to wound, which they can turn on with a stratagem. So at that point, yeah, no.
Not very synergistic.
Not going to bother. Just run them. Run them cheap and cheerful. Don't worry with a leader.
So a question that I asked yesterday to Manny and Ed Watts, because we were doing an episode on top 7 combat units in the game. They didn't mention Arco Flagellants, but one question that I asked them that I would like you to answer as well is, before the balanced data slate, or after 10th came out, there was this sort of, let's say, very energetic reaction, negative reaction to how combat has been treated this edition. And many players, first of all, quite unhappy about where combat is and how it works now. And second of all, turning away from combat in favor of shooting units, because it seems that shooting is what gets you to the top spots at tournaments and so on. So two questions in one. First of all, do you still recommend taking units like Arcoflagellants, for example, in a Sisters army, or should Sisters focus more on shooting with their Nolas shooting, with their Meltas and so on? And second question, is there anything that you think could be done to improve combat or to bring it to its previous glory, where it used to be like the place where you could manifest your skill and so on and so on?
So I think that's an interesting question. So I think the first answer is yes, I do think Sisters players should be taking melee units. I think their shooting isn't good enough that they can just lean on shooting alone. They have a natural incentive towards taking some melee from acts of faith, because it gives them the ability to execute reliable charges out of reserves. And I think their melee units are pretty good. Like, I think Paragons with Vol are a more obvious, you know, thing that you'll see more of after the data slate. I think Repentia are fine. I think Sacrosants are fine. And I think Arcoflagellants are good. But I think the Arcoflagellants actually illustrate quite nicely that what I think you want from, in some ways, I do agree that in general across the game, melee is not quite where it should be. So but there are still melee units that can, you know, that can bully something squishier than them. Mm-hmm. So I think what you want from a melee unit, basically, you either want one of the few ones that you can stack enough stuff on that they're really deadly, or really, really durable. So Lich Guard, Deathwing Knights, or you want something that's cheap, and will still cheap, not trivial to take out, and will still bully stuff that isn't spec to take them on. So like, you can't ignore a unit of Arcoflagellants in your backfield. They can't be the anchor that's underpinning your whole strategy, but they're also dangerous enough that you can't just pretend they're not there. Particularly if they're coming in from strat reserves with the threat of a good charge. So I think they fit into a quite good niche in that regard. I think other things like it. So actually, we saw a list go past last week where someone had got out Wolfen for the first time this edition, which was very surprising to me initially, because Wolfen have got one of the biggest edition to edition changes. But actually, the way they were using them looked like it was basically just as similar, in that it was a big roving, this is deadly enough that you can't just pretend it's not there, but it doesn't cost too many points, so mm-hmm. it's not sort of underpinning my whole strategy. And I guess the other thing that you do want for melee units is rerolls, which these have built in, so that's always nice. I think more widely in the game, I'm generally not of the opinion, so I have never been a huge fan of the melee positioning stuff as the holy grail of competitive play, because I think I'm sort of a big advocate for making competitive play welcoming and wanting more people in it. And I think it got better in 9th. I think 9th was an okay balance, but in 8th in particular, the stuff you could do in the fight phase, if you really know what you're doing, was very off-putting to
newer players.
Player acquisition, because it basically, you got into the fight phase and then you lost for reasons you could barely understand without really doing anything that was obviously wrong. And I think that's something that you really want to avoid. And I think it's clearly something the Games Workshop doesn't like, because, you know, they tightened things up in 9th, and they've tightened things up further in 10th. And I quite like the change in, I'm generally more of a fan of this sort of more streamlined version we have now. I appreciate that some people miss the depth of the old system. But I basically think you should be able to have a system like you have now and have melee units still worth taking. I think that's kind of where things have fallen down, is that in general, I don't think melee units are powerful enough. I think our general consensus sort of in our team is that basically where they've generally taken a point of AP off every gun in the game, they shouldn't have done that for melee. I think melee the intrinsic need to get into combat before you can start doing anything with it means that melee can afford to be a bit more deadly when it gets there. And I basically just think that almost every melee weapon in the whole game could do with one more point of AP than it has. So my fix to that would be that I think the charge bonus should be extended to give you plus one to AP on the turn you charge as well. And I think that would go a long way. I think that's a fairly safe broad brush thing you could apply to pretty much the whole game. And that would get it back to a much better place.
Let's just hope that GW listens to this podcast and listens to you and that they introduce it, because it's a really interesting concept that wouldn't be game breaking, but definitely would be impactful for some armies. Okay, moving on to your second to last pick.
So number two, we're back on an Eldari theme, which is the Void Raven Bomber. Okay. So the Void Raven Bomber is I think the only one of the few of those. So the Fugin didn't either, but Void Raven Bomber didn't go down in cost on this list. Same price as it has been all the way through. I think the reason I to sort of to highlight the Void Raven Bomber, I think, well, number one, Drukharian are in a much better place to give it a shell to operate. So although the Void Raven didn't go down, Drukhari mostly did, with the exception of Ravagers going up. But that's arguably to the Void Raven's advantage because it makes it more competitive. Like, I think it's fair enough that with 95-point Ravagers, it was very, very difficult to ever justify taking a Void Raven over two whole Ravagers. I think now it's much closer to something you'd be willing to consider. And the reason I think the Void Raven's worth highlighting is that with the towering change, only aircraft can now no scope over ruins, but aircraft still can. The problem is that the vast majority of things that are aircraft aren't really worth taking. Like a lot of aircraft, I have three lovely Eldari planes on my shelf, and I think they're going to be paying for the sins of late 8th edition for a long time. Probably maybe they'll be allowed to be good in 11th edition again. I don't know. But in general, they've been very cautious with shooty aircraft, and I think this is one of the challenges with doing as big a change as 10th is. I think actually the more structural changes they've made in 10th meant that they probably didn't need to be as cautious as they were with the costings on aircraft. I think in general, actually, they could have been more aggressive with the data sheets, because I think the sort of system level rules changes do enough to rein them in. But I think the Void Raven is one of the very few out there where actually the numbers are kind of good enough. And I think that so one thing that if Drukhari players haven't looked closely at the data sheet, they may not have noticed is that in previous editions, the Void Raven basically had two slightly better Dark Lancers or two slightly better Disintegrators. It now has two massively better Dark Lancers or massively better Disintegrators, because it now gets twice the shots as well as improved other stats. So when you've got one, if you've got one of these coming in from Strat Reserves, you've got four, I think it's strength 14 Dark Lance equivalent shots, which is a lot. And I think Drukhari use that particularly well, because their pain tokens incentivize anything that crams a lot of firepower onto one unit. It means that you get more bang for your buck if you bring one of these in and give it full rerolls. And I think it's just worth, again, it's going to be interesting to see how the dynamic works. And I'm really interested to see on the LGT terrain in particular, now that Ruin sort of provide much more of an impact on sort of the sight lines game wide, whether stuff can hide almost too well in some cases. So I think there's a real part of me that looks at the Void Raven and goes, maybe I want this as a wild card that actually does give me the ability to come in from a board edge and threaten pretty much anywhere on the table with some really nasty shots and rerolls. The mine's also still very good. It's hard to set up now because you don't pivot before you move, so you do have to sort of point it somewhere where you think the opponent's going to have to leave stuff, but the base is nearly as wide as the area of controlling an objective, so if you make sure you've lined it up so it's going over an objective you're pretty sure your opponent wants, then they're not going to have that much of a choice if they want to take that objective. But I think the power that you get out of one of these is really considerable. I think the other thing you should probably keep something of an eye on for them is whether people try them in Inari as well, because they're really good shooting. So going into Inari and having the battle host rerolls or potentially guide dropped on them is plausible as well. So I think it's very easy to come to a rule of thumb at the moment to basically just ignore shooty aircraft completely, because most of them are not great. Like, I think a lot of them need some serious help. This is pretty much the one where I'm sort of going, actually, there is almost something there, and I can certainly if you end up with we've seen a lot of initial marine builds that are packing quite a lot of non-invun hulls. If that sort of, you know, after day, it's like, if that endures into their new codex, then I think this is a real consideration, because the ability to come in from deep strike and pop a non-invun tank, even if it's hiding behind a ruin, is something that may help swing that matchup.
Mm-hmm. So one thing that I caught on you saying was that LGT terrain might actually encourage using a plane like this. And I wanted to ask you about terrain in general and the direction that the major events have taken with terrain, because both the LGT and the WTC have gone the way of city fight, let's call it. So mainly ruins, either more or less dense tables, but still mainly ruins. And I understand that this is dictated by practicality primarily, more than anything else. But are you personally happy with that direction? Because there, I've heard voices already, both in the Polish community, in like people, casual, you know, non-competitive players who comment on like the pictures of the Polish national team about from pictures from tournaments, who say, yeah, oh my god, this is so boring. Like, the tables all look the same, only ruins, ruins, ruins. Is that the way to go? And should practicality be the first aspect taken into account when designing tables? Or will there come a time when we will see, I don't know, hills, barricades, or any other things at tournaments as well?
So I think that's an interesting question. So I actually think one of the things I really like about the 10th edition terrain rules is that I think it makes hills and things like statues a much more useful feature of a table. Because they now do provide cover when partially obscuring, and do that nice and broadly to lots of different things, I think they do way more for the game. Because I think part of the reason the community moved so hard away from hills and the like in the past is that essentially, unless the hill was big enough to physically block line of sight to something, all it was doing was making the game, you know, less functional on the table. Whereas now, you get a lot more out of them. So actually, we ran the UK Goonhammer Open a few weeks back, and we had some either crate stacks or sort of small walls running using the rules for sort of statues or battlefield obstacles, or whatever it's called, to give cover. And I really like having some of that on the table. I think that actually adds a lot. In terms of the sort of the visual aspect for sort of casuals, I think realistically, you're never going to have a practical tournament terrain set that's really, really appealing to casual players. We got the same thing where we had a few people commenting on our tables, and we were using some new stuff from Bandura Wargaming that I think looks really nice. Like, I think it's some of the nicest looking tournament terrain we've had in play. But even then, we got some people coming out saying, oh, it's so boring, it's all L's, and it's just I think you're always going to be warring between practicality for gaming, practicality for event organizers, and, you know, visual quality.
Appealing.
I think it's nice if the terrain is a bit more visually interesting than just grey ruins. If you can do it, I understand why at the size the UKCC runs, that's not really viable. We've certainly tried to do a bit more than that with the stuff we're using, but I think in general, and also particularly because Games Workshop are pushing mostly using ruins in their pack with the area things, with the sort of the area mats that or acrylic that they use, I think you're going to continue seeing ruins being the default. And I don't even necessarily think that's a particularly bad thing. Like, again, you know, tournament terrain is for a different thing than pure narrative terrain is. I have lots of nice narrative terrain at home. again, as we sort of, we had some people saying, oh, it's really boring that, you know, on our event, oh, it's boring that it's all the elves. And it's like, well, okay, you can go and look at the Horus Heresy tables that we're running in the other room where we've got all this narrative terrain set out. Mm-hmm. That's what we want for narrative play. And what we want for tournament play is nice, clear, unambiguous tables. I do think we will see more experimentation with hills, though. I think forests, maybe less so. I don't think they've really nailed forests. I don't think they do quite enough. And I think mm-hmm. the ambiguity, the sort of, and different ways people play with whether trees are sort of passable to hulls or whatever tends to confuse the issue. So I don't think you'll see forests in tournament play. I think things like hills and statues, we've been trying out some small things that are using those rules on our maps. I think they work quite well. I think we'll see people trying those a bit more. Certainly, I think on the on the LGT, you could replace the very small ruin bits with like a statue or whatever. Obviously, there aren't as many sort of, they aren't as easy to make MDF flat pack kits for, so you may also not see that. But I think there's, again, the LGT still presumably has somewhere the industrial box hills they used to use. I'd certainly be interested to see some of those coming out for some maps in the future, because I think there's a lot more to do with them this edition than previously.
So what do you think about the question from the chat? Do you think vents could make a return, maybe giving stealth to units within?
I quite like that cover is always saves, and I think it generally ends up more impactful. I think giving out dents looked interesting at the start of ninth, but ended up being mostly a failed experiment. Partially because, as I mentioned before, because you couldn't stack the minus one from dents with other sources of minus one, it ended up sometimes just not really mattering at all. Or, you know, it meant that, oh, well, they're behind dents, so I can just advance and I don't suffer any downsides for it because my assault weapons, well, I'm going to be at minus one anyway. Whereas saves always matter, pretty much, not 100% of the time, but a lot more of the time saves matter, particularly with the AP being generally reduced across the board. So I think there's certainly scope for more things to be tried with terrain. I think the core terrain rules they've got are very, you know, they're very streamlined, and you know, certainly in editions gone by, they've done things like city fight books or whatever to add expanded terrain rules. I think it's certainly somewhere where if they wanted to really shake things, and I think actually, I know the Age of Sigmar competitive packs have been doing a lot more with sort of shaking up fundamentals of the game in each year's GT, their equivalent of the GT pack. So I could certainly see them turning around and going, okay, for this year, you know, for 2020, well, whatever, whenever they next do a pack, they could turn around and go, okay, well, let's take an inspiration from Age of Sigmar and actually, let's say, when you're fighting missions from this pack, here are some fundamental changes to the, you know, or fundamental extensions to the core rules, like whole new types of terrain. And I certainly think there's stuff you could experiment with in there. I'm sure stealth is one of the ones they'd look at, because I think it's such an obvious thing to put in there. But I generally think that moving away from handing out stealth as the benefit was the right call, because I think it just too often didn't really do anything.
Mm-hmm. New season, night fight. In the first yes. round, everyone is under stealth.
I've had that suggestion a few times. Yeah. I think I'd be interested in seeing, you know, I think I'd be interested in seeing some stuff around, you know, modifiers to Overwatch for being a certain terrain, or, you know, maybe if you, you know, choose things you can choose to do instead of shooting, like choose to, you know, if you're in the woods, choose to hit the deck and get the, you can't be shot outside 12 inches or something like that. I think there's places you can go with it. I'd be interested to see if they do end up doing some more experimentation. Yeah.
So we've digressed a lot, but I loved it, to be perfectly honest. So I don't think it's a huge problem. But let's at least try. Wait, I think there's a comment.
Yeah, stand your ground. Yes. Something like that. Yeah, I think that would be good. I also think, yeah, I think there's some stuff that I was a bit sad to not see make it into. So I was expecting some of the stuff from boarding actions to maybe come into tents. I was a bit sad. I actually really like the boarding actions Overwatch implementation, and I was a bit sad not to see that make it into into 10th edition. So I think maybe something, some, you know, playing in that area where it's essentially a, you know, in certain conditions you can do a special kind of action to prepare something. I think that would be a, that would be a way to go with terrain rules.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Let's at least attempt to finish the top seven list.
Yes, I'm afraid I do have to go to bed fairly soon.
Same about us. So what is your number seven?
So it's the one that's in my LGT list, which is the Necron Monolith.
Which is an amazing choice in itself, but tell us all about it. Why did you decide to pick it?
So like a lot of things in this list, it has gone down slightly in price. And I think, again, some of its comparators or competitors have gone up in price. So in particular, Doomsday Arcs have gone up, Monoliths come down. So much like with the Void Raven Ravager comparison, it looks, it's less a case that you could literally take, you can't literally take two whole Doomsday Arcs instead of your Monolith now, which makes it a lot more competitive. I think but the big thing that it does for you is it gives you mobility. It gives you the ability to get stuff around the board. So what the Monolith lets you do basically is pick up a unit, zap it to the Monolith, in your reserve step. And unlike a lot of things, it doesn't have a nine inch limit on bringing that in. You can't charge afterwards, so you can't just use it to ram Lich Guard at the opponent's face. But if you need to get something from A to B, which I think Necrons in general are a bit slower this edition, particularly because their melee stuff, which tends to be their faster units, are some of the weaker things. So you want to build in tools that that give you the ability to get around the table. And yes, actually, as one of your commenters has just pointed out, it's the only way to effectively fall back and shoot with something like a big block of warriors. And that's certainly one of the failure states for warriors at the moment, is if they get bogged down in melee, like they can stay in melee forever, but they won't do anything. You can maybe punch your way out if you've got Orokan, but if you can use a monolith to just pull them out of melee and then blast whatever they're in combat with, then you're golden. It's also really tough, and it's got pretty decent shooting. Like, it's T14, which is T14 and a 2+ save, which is, you know, even in the expanded range of what 10th edition gives you, that's a big stat line. There are not, you know, lots of things are going to be, even dedicated anti-tanks often going to be wounding on fives. Most chip damage is sixes. It's pretty good in the mirror, because you can ram it into Lich Guard, and the cap of where they can get their strength is seven. So they're just you can, you know, use it to bodily block your opponent's Lich Guard for as long as you need to. And it's pretty good at shooting as well. Like, it's not sort of earth shattering, but it's going to do some damage. And again, with the increase in prevalence of non-invuntoting marine vehicles, the death rays are looking, you know, extra spicy. So I think I think one of the biggest ways to push back against Necrons is to try and debuff their movement. So I've played into Night Spinners a few times with my Necrons now. I didn't enjoy the experience particularly, because a unit of Lich Guard that can only move 3 inches and can't advance is effectively out of the game.
You're talking to a Death Guard player, so I know exactly what you're...
Yes, yes. So then you know the pain, yes. And I think you basically just want to build in mitigations for that. Obviously, you've already got some mobility. You've got the Veil of Darkness. You've got the Super Catan. And I think Necrons have a really good suite of units, some great durability. Their weak spot basically is, particularly with the change to Doomsdays, it's harder for them to get sort of go over the top levels of firepower on the table, and the Monolith helps with that. But it's mobility that'll kill them if the opponent can just outdo them. And the Monolith, if they don't deal with it, gives such sort of enormous amounts of mobility and area control. And it's hard for them to kill when they try, that I think it's really valuable. And in fact, I've just finished painting mine this afternoon, so I'm ready for the LGT now. It's been what I've spent most of my Sunday doing, is doing the last bits of detailing on it.
Sweet.
So does it actually get anywhere now on the table?
It can deep strike, so kind of you can deep strike, and the area you can zap things into around it is within 6 inches and no 9-inch limitation. So on the LGT tables, even if you're if you decide to put it on the board, on their search and destroy style maps, if you just put it behind the ruin that's near the center, then you've got you can zap stuff straight onto the middle objective using it. And you know you can tow it into the ruin and then it can see a lot of the table. I meant to ask
because I think what was it on Friday evening? I played a game with my Death Guard against an opponent from Australia, and we played, albeit on WTC tables. But it turned out that my invitational list, which contains 2 Land Raiders for Death Guard, got stuck on the WTC terrain, and the Land Raiders couldn't leave the deployment zone.
Yeah.
So, in your case, with the Monolith, is Deep Strike the only option? Because I'm looking, I guess we're all looking at the layouts right now. So this is like round 2.
So I need to put it on. So I think I realistically I'm expecting to Deep Strike it in a lot of my games, because I think it's difficult for them to zone it out completely. And it gives you a lot of pressure out of Deep Strike too, because you can Deep Strike it and then immediately zap a unit to it as well. So honestly, you often want to be Deep Striking it. Again, I could be hilariously wrong. Like I am mindful of the possibility that I am going to lose at least one game to getting stuck. But I think I guess the other thing also is because it's got that 6-inch reach. Even if you are having, even if it, on those maps you're showing, even if it does get stuck on the edge of your deployment zone, it's still not doing nothing. As long as you can tow it in to shoot out, it's got good reach. It can move stuff into a position you need them in. But yeah, I think in general, you want to be deep striking it to get the big value anyway. At that point, as long as you can deep strike it past that first line, then you're good. Oh, I've lost you. You're on mute.
I'm on mute because I keep coughing all the time, so I didn't want that to go into the microphone. So sorry for that. As I said at the very beginning, when I saw your choices for the first time, I was like, okay, very interesting list. And I was really curious to hear the justification for that. Now I know, I'm actually tempted to use the, although you said that the Great Unclean One will not benefit as much from being an ally as it would in a clear demon's army. I think I'm going to get a Great Unclean One.
I think Rotagus is quite good in an allied one. I think I'm just trying to remember what he does, because again, the named ones give you the give you sort of a lot of the same capabilities, but without being so reliant on upgrades. Just loading up, reminding myself what Rotagus.
Yeah, also looking for him right now.
He's okay-ish. I looked them up whilst we were talking about it, but I didn't see this list before before we actually went live, and the last 2 data sheets, I was like, what's this guy on about? And I did have to take a look at the Void Raven to remind myself what does it do and if it actually does have a place. Maybe.
There you have this handsome.
So Rotagus, probably not, to be honest on him. I think if you're going with an allied one, it's probably Shalaxy, just because even at the higher cost, they're so fast and so deadly. Particularly again, as you don't have to worry about them getting blasted by enemy towering stuff now. I'd that's where I'd go if I wanted a demon ally.
Mm-hmm. Although that aura of halving movement and objective control. Bad. It's not bad for on a tough 12 body with 22 wounds. I mean, I'll have a think. Thank you for giving me food for thought. I appreciate it a lot, and I hope our viewers appreciate it as well. So, Joker, do you have any final questions, or will we be wrapping this one up?
Well, I think that our guest mentioned wanting to go to sleep. So, if he does not have any final comments about his top 7 list or expectations, or I don't know anything around the OGT, then we can close the show.
Okay. Thank you very much for having me. Looking forward to seeing you guys next week at the LGT.
And likewise.
Yeah.
Yeah. To all our watchers, viewers, listeners, please like, subscribe, hit that alert button on YouTube so you get the notification when we go live while we are at DLGT, so you don't miss it. Also, please do consider becoming a patron if you want this show, if you want to see this show develop, if you want to see it grow bigger, if you want to see have its own equipment that we can take to events and broadcast and so on. So yeah, that would be your help will be very, very welcome. Yeah, I think that's it. Congratulations to our winners, Zozo and Julian. We will be reaching out to you after the show, or probably tomorrow. And yeah, to all our listeners, until next time. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.